Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, the University of Wisconsin is a leader in many fields, and bioenergy and green technology is certainly no exception. And today we have with us a couple of guests to talk about some really cool work that they're doing. John Greenler directs the education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, the GLBRC, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, as always, great to have you with us. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Also with us today, George Huber, a first-timer here as well. He is a professor of chemical and biological engineering at the UW-Madison, a researcher with the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And he is working on converting biomass to aviation fuel. And George, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you with us today to learn some more about this. Let's start with sort of a basic fact or two here. What percentage of fuel use is linked to aviation? Do we have some sort of...
I think it's about 20 to 30% of our fuels goes to aviation fuels.
Mm-hmm. And is that primarily commercial aviation then, or is it...
Yeah, commercial aviation fuels.
And what are the types of fuels that are commonly used by airplanes?
It's mainly a jet fuel. There is a aviation gasoline that's used as well, but that's a lot less common than the jet fuels. And there's a few different types of jet fuels. The military actually has their own special types of jet fuels that they use. And the military really likes a single source fuel. And the reason I'm talking so much about the military is because what the project we're going to talk a little bit about today is the one that was originally funded by the military, mm-hmm. which is the largest fuel user in this country.
Oh, the military is. Well, yeah. I guess when you stop to think about it, that could be the case. Well, what is it? What is it about aviation fuel? Why can't I put that in my car?
Well, you know, the fuels are really separated by their distillation range, or the temperature at which they boil. They become gases. So you really separate that by their boiling point.
Okay.
Gasoline is a mixture. So the most volatile cut, if you start boiling something, the thing that's going to boil first is going to be gasoline. Then after that's going to be jet fuel. And then after that, the jet fuel is almost almost straight run kerosene, what we call in the petroleum refinery. And then the heaviest stuff usually is the diesel fuel. And the jet and diesel fuel really are what we call distillate fuels. Those are the heavier fuels. And in the future, we think there's going to be an increasing demand for distillate fuels worldwide.
Oh, and why?
You know, I think there's other, there's other options for gasoline. You know, there's the hybrid electric vehicles, which improve efficiency. There's electric vehicles. But, you know, really, we'll always need these distillate fuels to run heavy machinery. Right. You know, you really can't fly an airplane on electricity. Just that energy density is not there. When we're talking about these fuels, liquid fuels are really optimal for their energy density. And the jet engine really has been optimized for this jet fuel.
Right. Yeah. And the same is true if you look at, like, you know, the trucking industry. We're not going to see, you know, tractor trailers driving around, you know, powered by batteries as well. It's just they just have too heavy a load. But yeah, in the future, when we're looking at cars, you know, EVs is a good example, electric vehicles, which we've talked about in previous shows. You know, I think there's a very high odds we're going to see a significant increase in numbers displacing gasoline in the not too distant future.
Interesting. Talking today about biofuels for aviation with George Huber, professor of chemical and biological engineering at UW-Madison, and John Greenler, who directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I haven't given the number, but let me invite you to join in. You may have questions about these fuels. Does the environmental impact of airplane travel, does that have any influence on your travel decisions, for example? But you may have other questions or comments as well. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Well, the financial costs of these fuels and environmental costs, I imagine, John, is pretty high.
Yeah, very significant. And, you know, it's easy to see the financial end of it. You know, we think about that when we buy an airplane ticket. But, Larry, I appreciate your pointing out the environmental concerns as well. So, for example, I think it's frequently easy to miss the fact that when we fly, you know, our carbon footprint is really quite large. We're not in the air for a very long time, but we're going a lot of miles. And, you know, when we use petroleum-based fuels, we are releasing a lot of carbon in the atmosphere that was frequently, you know, locked up underground, you know, as petroleum. So this is also very significant. If we can come up with, you know, a biofuel alternatives that, you know, that really significantly reduce our carbon, net carbon emissions, that's a very significant gain.
And George, that's kind of what you got. How'd you get interested in this, by the way?
Well, I actually got my PhD from University of Wisconsin, so uh-huh. I'm a graduate from here, and my background really is in chemical engineering in a field of called catalysis, and you know, in the field of catalysis is really used in the whole petroleum industry, whole chemical industry. Most of your manufactured products have a catalyst around somewhere in the process. So I was really interested in studying catalysts. The first project I was interested in was taking natural gas and trying to like make liquid fuels, trying to make gasoline from natural gas. And then I came here to Wisconsin and we started working on how can we convert renewable sources of materials using these same types of catalysis, and how can we take biomass and other renewable sources and convert those? I then went off to University of Massachusetts for several years, did a stay in Spain, and then I've come back. So that's how I got interested. You know, we learned how to use these catalysis really from the petroleum industry. You know, and really we use them on how to convert petroleum into make gasoline from petroleum-derived feedstocks, jet fuel from petroleum-derived feedstocks. Also, catalysts are used on your car in the three-way catalytic converter to reduce your emissions there. Most of your plastics, all your plastics, there's a catalyst somewhere in this process. So that's what we study, catalyst.
And again, a catalyst is,
it's a substance that speeds up rates of certain reactions. So you can think you have biomass, it could go to jet fuel, or it can go to what we call coke, which is a very low value product. So we want to find catalysts that maximize our rate to the jet fuel and minimize the coke formation.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes some that makes some sense, John.
Definitely. No, it's a very powerful area of research, and when you hit that right mix, you know, it doesn't take a lot of catalyst. A catalyst is not a fundamental part of the reaction, is just facilitating, you know, that reaction. So it, you know, you just need very small quantities in the right place at the right time, the right conditions, and you can do things which, you know, from one perspective seem somewhat miraculous even. So
John and Rhinelander has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi John, thanks for calling.
Hi Larry. You know, the problem that I have, I found out recently here in the last few years, is that this idea that biofuels have a smaller carbon footprint than their petroleum-based cohorts is a myth, and that it's more like 1.5 to 2 times more carbon is emitted when you're making biofuels because of the farming activities, because of the fertilizer, especially ammonia fertilizer is a huge source of greenhouse gases, with nitrous oxide being 300 times worse than carbon dioxide. From applying ammonia. There's a whole bunch of runoff from the fields. And not only that, but what you're doing is you're taking crops that would normally, part of it would be put back in the soil to build the soil, and that carbon would be put back. You're taking that all and you're burning it out the tailpipe of the car or the plane. So,
well, I'm sure we've got some comments from John Greenler. We start with you.
Sure. Yeah, no, John, I really appreciate your concern on that front, and you're exactly right. I mean, there's the opportunity with biofuels to do it right or do it wrong, especially, you know, in this area in terms of carbon emissions. And when we look at our current biofuel technology, making, for example, ethanol from corn grain, we're really not seeing a significant gain. And you're pointing out a number of the critical concerns. For example, you know, we grow corn. We do need to use a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, and the production, the synthesis of that fertilizer does require a lot of energy. going into it, and correspondingly, you get a pretty big carbon footprint. And really, what we're looking at in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute are what we would call future biofuels, where we're using fundamentally different types of biomass that we're really going to lower that. Very little fertilizer needed, for example, other energy inputs. So,
and we'll talk some more about that. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, there's a lot of really cool research that goes on at the University of Wisconsin. And there's a lot of research that goes on in the area of green technology and bioenergy. And one of the neat things that researchers are doing here right now is working on biofuels for aviation. And the guy who's doing a lot of it is one of our guests today. George Huber is professor of chemical and biological engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, researcher with the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and he's joined with John Greenler, who's been a regular on our show for a long, long time. John directs education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC, as we usually call it, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And guys, thank you so much for being with us. And just before our news break, John, we had a caller who had some concerns about this this type of fuel.
Right. So, yeah, he was calling and really wondering about, concerned about the carbon footprint of different types of biofuels. And I think one of the tools that we use to address this whole area is what's known as a life cycle assessment or a life cycle analysis, an LCA for short. And this really is an accounting where we really look from cradle to grave, you know, at all of the inputs and outputs from these kinds of systems, plow to pump, so to speak, as well, if you're looking at a biofuel. And one of the most common dimensions that we're considering in this is carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions, even more broadly, because the caller was exactly right. When we're looking at, you know, at growing a crop, there are a lot of inputs in terms of producing something like corn, especially. So it's an annual crop. It is very intensive to grow, both in terms of fertilizer, but also in terms of machinery. It's an annual, so we need to replant it every year. So there's a lot of different things that we need to take into consideration. Irrigation is another good example. And so we really need to look at, you know, how much energy goes in and correspond to that energy. What are the carbon emissions as well? And one thing to keep in mind is that even when we look at corn grain to ethanol technology, there's been significant improvements over the past 20 years. So some very early studies were done. David Pimentel, for example, is a researcher at Cornell, you know, who really kind of started a lot of this area. And the initial numbers were indeed quite poor. But the industry has taken
this. That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. And a lot has changed in terms of the technology. So it's still a significant concern. And, I think the technology has matured quite a bit. You know, some of the numbers I see is that it's about maybe a 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. For example, if you're looking at corn grain-based ethanol versus gasoline today. But when we begin to look at using fibrous plant material, so like the corn stover that's left over after the corn grain harvest, or growing something like switchgrass, you know, we're looking at a much higher reduction, you know, 80 or 90% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions associated with those crops. So, and so no surprise, that's really where a lot of the research that we're doing here at the university is really focused. So, yeah. You know, can we become more secure in terms of our energy portfolio? Can we be economical? And can we be more environmentally friendly, especially within this greenhouse gas emission domain?
And you know, George, I think you have in some ways, a harder row to hoe than many, because aviation fuel, you know, your work is to, well, let's have an aviation fuel, a good one. It has very high testing requirements.
Yeah, that's right. There's a long string of requirements you have to go to get your fuel specified where you can actually fly it in a commercial aviation airplane. I think, you know, you have to go through produce about 100,000 gallons of jet fuel and do different testing in the laboratory with laboratory jet jet rigs before you could go commercial to get this fuel tested. And, you know, that's very expensive just to produce that fuel on that laboratory scale and run through these tests. And, you know, and that it takes a long time before these fuels can get implemented, these technologies can be implemented commercially at the commercial level. But I think at the point, you know, at the end of the day, we want to have a liquid transportation fuel that can power jets and other heavy machinery that's renewable and environmentally friendly and doesn't have the CO2 emissions.
Yeah, and you got to start somewhere. I mean, you got to start somewhere with the research on it, and you're obviously doing that. Tell us a bit more about what you're honing in on right now in terms of product.
Yeah, so you know, everything that is made from petroleum, we can make from biomass. So we can make gasoline, we can make diesel fuel, we can make jet fuels, and we can make all the same plastics that you make from biomass. And so if you give us a molecule, we can go in the lab and we can show, okay, this is these are two or three routes you could make them from biomass. The problem is really making them economical. Mm-hmm. So being able to show on a large commercial plant, you know, these are all commodities. Nobody wants to spend, you know, 10 cents more per gallon, even 5 cents more per gallon for a renewable fuel. You have to be cost competitive. Mm-hmm. And they're very expensive. It's very expensive to produce them on a large commercial scale. And then your first real biorefinery of this scale is going to cost you anywhere from $500 million to $1 billion.
Yeah.
So they're going to be very expensive. You know, it's a very large capital investment that you have to make originally. So our challenge right now is really to make them cheaper and do the fundamental research and show the problems from the engineering point of view, what's the expensive step, and then design catalysts that can reduce the cost of these technologies.
What are the catalysts that you use in your processes?
Yeah, so for this jet fuel project, we have about 5 or 6 different catalysts. Most of these are solid catalysts, so they're an area of what we call heterogeneous catalysts. A lot of these catalysts have very high surface areas, so a few grams of the material have the same surface, because all your catalytic reactions take place on the surface of the catalyst. So a few grams of these catalysts have surface areas of a football field. And some of them have precious metals, platinum, palladium, you know, very small amounts, and those are very expensive. So one of our big challenges right now is to try and find a replacement for platinum, which we think we have. We think we have a catalyst that's cobalt, which is probably 1/1000th of the cost. Mm. So these are all, you know, high surface area material, solid catalysts that we use.
Talking today with George Huber and John Greenler about the research going on at UW-Madison about biofuels for aviation. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Cody in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for having me. I've always been interested in fuel cells, especially your hydrogen. It seems like the perfect fuel if you can store it safely, that its only byproduct is water when it's released. And I've also read about photosynthesis as a way to directly make hydrogen as opposed to making a biofuel. Is that possible? Can a fuel cell power an airplane or a jet? And where's the technology on that coming?
Yeah, okay. George, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. Cody, thanks for the great question. Fuel cells really can't power a jet or a diesel engine because you really can't get the energy density. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these drones, which are very lightweight that the military uses, do actually use fuel cells, and so some of them can use the fuel cells. But you could potentially power a gasoline engine with a fuel cell. Unfortunately, they haven't brought the cost of the fuel cell down low enough to really be powering it in gasoline engines. And there's some concern that you know, it's very hard to replace the internal combustion engine. Now, this work with hydrogen production, we need hydrogen for our technology. So in a lot of our technologies, we need a source of hydrogen. And right now, we assume that we're getting the hydrogen from steam reforming of natural gas, which is how hydrogen is produced conventionally today. That's the lowest cost method. If you could get it from water with solar water splitting, and we are trying to do that as well, trying to develop ways to split water with solar energy and generate hydrogen there. The problem is they're just that cost is, again, it all comes down to cost. You know, you can do a lot of things in the lab, but then is it going to be economically viable? And that cost is about 10 to 100 times more expensive than making hydrogen from natural gas today.
The other, just to add another piece to that, is that the hydrogen technology will really require whole new infrastructure. You know, if we're talking about making a drop-in, quote-unquote, replacement for jet or diesel fuel, we can use our existing pipelines and trucking systems, fueling stations, et cetera. Hydrogen, really, we would be starting from scratch. And so there's a financial expense to that, and then there's also just an environmental expense in terms of trying to set all that up. And it may work really well, you know, in certain areas, like in California, maybe on the highway corridor, we may see hydrogen cars, for example, but it's really tough when you're, you know, when you're really trying to start, you know, from the beginning with something like that.
Just thinking off the top of my head about an advantage in one way of working with the biofuel, with the airplane fuel, aviation fuel, is the distribution. It'd probably be a little easier with aviation than it would be with automobile because of the points of.
Mm-hmm.
It's
something. I mean, there's transportation issues on multiple fronts. Some of it, you know, there's the finished product, and there we've actually got a pretty good system worked out. And once again, you know, the research that George is doing is really would be a direct replacement, what's known as a drop-in fuel. The other transportation issue is getting that biomass, to the refinery, to speak. And there's some very interesting research going on how to stabilize and correspondingly densify biomass. So once again, thinking about that life cycle assessment, if we have to put a lot of energy into moving biomass around, our numbers aren't going to look so good. So working on, how those refineries are configured, are they distributed, are they kind of, refinery A and refinery B, so we can densify materials and move them around more efficiently is really critical as well.
Brian in Black River Falls, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I don't know if that was a sneeze, Gesundheit. I just heard a loud noise on my end.
Oh.
Hey, quick question for you guys. Thank you for taking my call, by the way.
Sure.
The one thing that I take a mild interest in this, like probably most folks, in the discussion with biomass, obviously there is the word biomass, mass. What approach, I guess, is current, and perhaps if you guys have any application or interest of what to do with if there's any waste product of that biomass and how you would either recycle or dispose of that. So I can hang up and listen to you guys' response on that.
Thanks, Brian. All right, George, you want to start with you or John?
Sure, I'll go ahead.
George,
start.
Go ahead.
In the integrated biorefinery, there's really no waste products. You know, there's the low value products are the electricity. So we would generate electricity and we would generate heat with the waste part of the biomass. And a lot of that heat is used to heat up different parts of your process, and you might be selling some green electricity back to the grid. Waste we would have would be wastewater. And then there's concerns about what to do with the wastewater, and we're looking at ways to recycle the wastewater in our process. And you would have to clean that up before that would be allowed to be discharged.
Hmm. Yeah, it's actually it's a very exciting area for us because what may initially seem like waste may actually end up in some cases being a fairly high value product. So for example, when we look at these cellulosic fuels, these fuels made from the fibrous plant materials, one of the common compounds that's in there is lignin. It's essentially is the glue that holds, holds those plant cell walls together and corresponding to the cellulose, et cetera. Initially it was like lignin was just perceived as being a problem. We now have some very interesting research going to indicate that we might find some very useful pharmaceutical compounds that are a part of the breakdown process of that lignin. And so it may really make the whole refinery process, much more economical. So we're always looking at creative ways, as George was saying, to essentially end up with no waste product.
Yeah, well, that's great. We have David in Dodgeville with a question about wastewater, I believe. Hi, David.
Hi. Yeah, I just kind of wondering why we haven't used our wastewater treatment plants more efficiently with methane gas and even the cow manure in the state of Wisconsin, why we haven't used that resource for making it more affordable for us.
Yeah, and actually there's a lot of exciting developments in that area here in Wisconsin in terms of using, especially, for example, manure from the dairy industry. Clay has value as a fertilizer. We can maintain that, but at the same time extract a lot of the energy through anaerobic digestion. And even more recently, we're looking at ways of actually adding other compounds, like, for example, some of the cellulosic material to make a heterogeneous mix, which would allow us to produce a lot of methane. Initially, like now we're seeing that being used on site on farms or a group of farms to generate electricity. But, it's really exciting. For example, if you go to Germany, where they also have a lot of dairy, they're actually taking that methane and going an additional step and cleaning it up a bit more. And they actually put it into their natural gas pipeline. So it's going into people's homes for heating and cooking, for example. So there's a lot of potential there. It doesn't have the same volume potential as some of these fibrous plant materials, but where we have it, we need to be taking full advantage of it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it also goes back to volume, John said. How much is there? There's a small amount, but there's a lot more lignocellulosic biomass, the woody biomass, the agricultural residues, and the biomass resources that were traditionally used for the pulp and paper industry.
There we go. Thanks. Go ahead, David.
I know there's a couple dairy farms up by Appleton that's actually using their Thalmanor to actually produce methane gas for electricity.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, there are actually several of them now. Yep. I can think of a couple here in southern Wisconsin as well. David, thank you very much for calling. I want to give Mark in Brookfield a chance to join in. Mark, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
Great. I have a question for these guys. I wonder if they're looking at industrial hemp as a source for their biomass, because it's got like 70% cellulose in the herds. And after you've harvested and done what you can and made money off of the bass fiber and what you can get off the seeds and oils, the leftover herds could really go a long ways towards making renewable fuels. And I wonder if you guys are looking at industrial hemp.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Actually, you can make some good fuel from hemp. Once again, it comes back to looking at this life cycle assessment component and really looking at the economics and things like the carbon footprint. So hemp is an annual crop, and so if we're going to plant a dedicated energy crop, it's much better to plant something perennial. Which is perennial. So switchgrass is a really good example of this. So where we have to plant it once, and then we're getting 20 or 30 years of harvest off of that. And so our fertilizer inputs are quite a bit less because these perennial plants have really deep root systems, very efficient. Same is true of irrigation. There's less machinery needed because we're not needing to plow on an annual basis. And so, yeah, we can do some good things with hemp, but in terms of that environmentally friendly component, it really falls short relative to things like switchgrass.
Joe in Prairie du Chien, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. To ask my mechanic about the difference between regular oil and synthetic, and he said if you look under a microscope, you can see particulate matter in the regular oil, but not in synthetic. Does the biofuel have the same situation, or is it cleaner? Does that affect the exhaust and maybe even engine wear?
Well, interesting question, too. Hi, George, what do you think?
Yeah, Joe, that's a great question, and that does depend a lot on the technology that you're used to make the biofuel and the type of biofuel you're made. But most of the technologies that make biofuels have very low particulate. So they have the potential to have a lot lower particulate emissions than conventional fuels. Like you think of the diesel fuel, you see all that soot and stuff coming off. The biofuels that you produce are a lot cleaner burning. Actually, biofuels, the biofuels were primarily produced in this country mainly for air pollution control, to try and reduce our CO emissions. And so we started adding ethanol in the fuels to improve our air quality.
Mm. Thank you very much for calling, Joe. Has, some of the South American country, Brazil, I guess, in terms of its uses a lot of biofuels for its automobiles. Have they done any work or research in the aviation area?
I've been down to Brazil. I've seen Petrobras. They're looking at all the products they can make from from biomass. You know, their main one is ethanol. And in Brazil, they go to the gas station and they can either put the ethanol or the gasoline in their car, and they have a little table they look at to look at which fuel is cheaper each day. And then the other thing they're doing in Brazil is they're making polyethylene, which is the plastic from ethanol as well. And they have a very large plant, and they sell their renewable polyethylene and their normal polyethylene made from ethylene derived from natural gas, two different types of plastic. So they are making lots of different products from the biomass, and that's really where this is, I think, really in developing countries where you're near the equator, you have great biomass resources, really is where biofuels is going to have the largest impact.
Yeah,
like in Brazil.
I would bet.
Yeah, and sugarcane, you know, is really, you know, the big crop in this domain in Brazil. And, you know, and for years they've been growing sugarcane. It's a perennial grass, which, again, somewhat like switchgrass. So very economical to grow, you know, and they've gotten very good at extracting the sap, which has a very high sugar content. And now, the exciting thing is what's left over is what they call bagasse, which is this fibrous residue material. And they're very heavily into the research of how to take that bagasse to turn it into a wide array of different types of biofuel.
Very cool.
And the Brazilian sugarcane industry, there's really three products you make from it. There's the ethanol, there's the sugar, and then there's electricity. So the waste part of the biomass, they convert into the electricity. When the price of sugar is high, they turn off their ethanol part, make more sugar. When the price of ethanol is low, then they'll convert that more into ethanol. And then they're taking the waste part, turning it into electricity, but then they say, what other products could we make from this waste part of the biomass?
I thought you were going to say one of the three was rum, but sugar, okay, which we could go to rum at some point. And your research, you know, you're going with both barrels, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fat. Working at, and what do you think in terms of timing? Do you think we'll, in 10 years we're going to have something close?
I think it could even be a little bit sooner than that. There's a lot of companies that have been announced different plants that they're building for different second generation mm-hmm. biorefinery technologies you're seeing online. A lot of them are receiving some government support. A lot of the companies, a lot of these projects have actually failed. Some are ongoing. So it's a very exciting time to be in this field to see some of these developments. And I think here at Wisconsin, we're the world leaders in the biofuel technology research.
And what's the website? What's your website?
www.goberc.org or wi.wis.edu. Sorry, yes.
Wisconsin Energy Institute.
Yes,
that's the other
you.
One. Oh, George,
Google will get you there.
George and John, thank you so much. George Huber, professor of chemical and biological engineering at UW-Madison. John Greenler directs education for the GLBRC and the WEI. Thank you for listening.